and with eyes closed addressed the heavenly powers in his weary, sorrowful sing-song. O eternal God, creator and preserver of all mankind, giver of all spiritual grace, the author of everlasting life, send thy blessing upon these thy servants, this man and this woman. The last brick was set in place, as the vicar, having put his glasses back on, made the celebrated pronouncement, man and wife together, and invoked the Trinity after which his church was named. There were more prayers, a psalm, the Lord's Prayer, and another long one in which the falling tones of valediction gathered into a melancholy finality. Pour upon you the riches of his grace, sanctify and bless you, that ye may please him both in body and soul, and live together in holy love until your lives end. Immediately, there cascaded from the fluting organ confetti of skittering triplets, as the vicar turned to lead the couple down the aisle and the six family members fell in behind. Bryony, who had been on her knees in a pretense of prayer, stood and turned to face the procession as it reached her. The vicar seemed a little pressed for time and was many feet ahead of the rest. When he glanced to his left and saw the young nurse, his kindly look and tilt of the head expressed both welcome and curiosity. Then he strode on to pull one of the big doors wide open. A slanting tongue of sunlight reached all the way to where she stood and illuminated her face and headdress. She wanted to be seen, but not quite so clearly. There would be no missing her now. Lola, who was on Bryony's side, drew level, and their eyes met. Her veil was already parted. The freckles had vanished, but otherwise she was not much changed. Only slightly taller, perhaps, and prettier, softer and rounder in the face, and the eyebrows severely plucked. Bryony simply stared. All she wanted was for Lola to know she was there and to wonder why. The sunlight made it harder for Bryony to see, but for a fraction of a moment, a tiny frown of displeasure may have registered in the bride's face. Then she pursed her lips and looked to the front, and then she was gone. Paul Marshall had seen her too, but had not recognised her, and nor had Aunt Hermione or Uncle Cecil, who had not met her in years. But the twins, bringing up the rear in school uniform trousers at half-mast, were delighted to see her, and mimed mock horror at her costume, and did clownish eye-rolling yawns with hands flapping on their mouths. Then she was alone in the church, with the unseen organist who went on playing for his own pleasure. It was over too quickly, and nothing for certain was achieved. She remained standing in place, beginning to feel a little foolish, reluctant to go outside. Daylight and the banality of family small talk would dispel whatever impact she had made as a ghostly illuminated apparition. She also lacked courage for a confrontation. And how would she explain herself, the uninvited guests, to her aunt and uncle? They might be offended. Or worse, they might not be, and want to take her off to some excruciating breakfast in a hotel with Mr. and Mrs. Paul Marshall oily with hatred, and Hermione failing to conceal her contempt for Cecil. Bryony lingered another minute or two, as though held there by the music, then, annoyed with her own cowardice, hurried out onto the portico. The vicar was 100 yards off at least, walking quickly away across the common with arms swinging freely. The newlyweds were in the rolls, Marshall at the wheel, reversing in order to turn round. She was certain they saw her. There was a metallic screech as he changed gear, a good sign, perhaps. The car moved away, and through a side window she saw Lola's white shape huddled against the driver's arm. As for the congregation, it had vanished completely among the trees. She knew from her map that Balham lay at the far end of the common, in the direction the vicar was walking. It was not very far, and this fact alone made her reluctant to continue. She would arrive too soon. She had eaten nothing. She was thirsty, and her heel was throbbing and had glued itself to the back of her shoe. It was warm now, and she would be crossing a shadeless expanse of grass, broken by straight asphalt paths and public shelters. In the distance was a bandstand where men in dark blue uniforms were milling about. She thought of Fiona, whose day off she had taken, and of their afternoon in St. James's Park. It seemed a far-off, innocent time, but it was no more than 10 days ago. Fiona would be doing the second bedpan round by now. Bryony remained in the shade of the portico and thought about the little present she would buy her friend. Something delicious to eat, a banana, oranges, Swiss chocolate. The porters knew how to get these things. She had heard them say that anything, everything was available if you had the right money. She watched the file of traffic moving round the common, along her route, and she thought about food. Slabs of ham, poached eggs, the leg of a roast chicken, thick Irish stew, lemon meringue, a cup of tea. She became aware of the nervy, fidgeting music behind her the moment it ceased, and in the sudden new measure of silence, which seemed to confer freedom, she decided she must eat breakfast. There were no shops that she could see in the direction she had to walk, only dull mansion blocks of flats in deep orange brick. Some minutes passed, and the organist came out holding his hat in one hand and a heavy set of keys in the other. She would have asked him the way to the nearest café, but he was a jittery-looking man, at one with his music, who seemed determined to ignore her as he slammed the church door shut and stooped over to lock it. He rammed his hat on and hurried away. Perhaps this was the first step in the undoing of her plans, but she was already walking back, retracing her steps, in the direction of Clapham High Street. She would have breakfast, and she would reconsider. Near the tube station she passed a stone drinking trough, and could happily have sunk her face in it. She found a drab little place with smeared windows and cigarette butts all over the floor, but the food could be no worse than what she was used to. She ordered tea and 3 pieces of toast and margarine and strawberry jam of palest pink. She heaped sugar into the tea, having diagnosed herself as suffering from hypoglycemia. The sweetness did not quite conceal a taste of disinfectant. She drank a second cup, glad that it was lukewarm so she could gulp it down. Then she made use of a reeking, seatless lavatory across a cobbled courtyard behind the café. But there was no stench that could impress a trainee nurse. She wedged lavatory paper into the heel of her shoe. It would see her another mile or two. A hand basin with a single tap was bolted to a brick wall. There was a grey-veined lozenge of soap she preferred not to touch. When she ran the water, the waste fell straight out onto her shins. She dried them with her sleeves and combed her hair, trying to imagine her face in the brickwork. However, she couldn't reapply her lipstick without a mirror. She dabbed her face with a soaked handkerchief and patted her cheeks to bring up the colour. A decision had been made, without her, it seemed. This was an interview she was preparing for, the post of beloved younger sister. She left the café, and as she walked along the common, she felt the distance widen between her and another self, no less real, who was walking back toward the hospital. Perhaps the Bryony who was walking in the direction of Balham was the imagined or ghostly persona. This unreal feeling was heightened when, after half an hour, she reached another high street, more or less the same as the one she had left behind. That was all London was beyond its centre, an agglomeration of dull little towns. She made a resolution never to live in any of them. The street she was looking for was 3 turnings past the tube station, itself another replica. The Edwardian terraces, net-curtained and seedy, ran straight for half a mile. 43 Dudley Villas was halfway down, with nothing to distinguish it from the others except for an old Ford 8, without wheels, supported on brick piles, which took up the whole of the front garden. If there was no one in, she could go away, telling herself she had tried. The doorbell did not work. She let the knocker fall twice and stood back. She heard a woman's angry voice, then the slam of a door and the thud of footsteps. Bryony took another pace back. It was not too late to retreat up the street. There was a fumbling with the catch and an irritable sigh, and the door was opened by a tall, sharp-faced woman in her 30s, who was out of breath from some terrible exertion. She was in a fury. She had been interrupted in a row, and was unable to adjust her expression, the mouth open, the upper lip slightly curled, as she took Bryony in.
"What do you want?"
"I'm looking for a Miss Cecilia Tallis." Her shoulders sagged, and she turned her head back as though recoiling from an insult. She looked Bryony up and down.
"You look like her."
Bewildered, Bryony simply stared at her. The woman gave another sigh that was almost like a spitting sound and went along the hallway to the foot of the stairs.
"Tallis!" she yelled. "Door!"
She came halfway back along the corridor to the entrance to her sitting room, flashed Bryony a look of contempt, then disappeared, pulling the door violently behind her. The house was silent. Bryony's view past the open front door was of a stretch of floral lino, and the first 7 or 8 stairs, which were covered in deep red carpet. The brass rod on the 3rd step was missing. Halfway along the hall was a semicircular table against the wall, and on it was a polished wooden stand like a toast rack for holding letters. It was empty. The lino extended past the stairs to a door with a frosted glass window, which probably opened onto the kitchen out the back. The wallpaper was floral too, a posy of 3 roses alternating with a snowflake design. From the threshold to the beginning of the stairs, she counted 15 roses, 16 snowflakes. Inauspicious. At last, she heard a door opening upstairs, possibly the one she had heard slammed when she had knocked. Then the creak of a stair, and feet, wearing thick socks, came into view, and a flash of bare skin and a blue silk dressing gown that she recognised. Finally, Cecilia's face tilting sideways as she leaned down to make out who was at the front door and spare herself the trouble of descending further, improperly dressed. It took her some moments to recognise her sister. She came down slowly another 3 steps. "Oh, my God." She sat down and folded her arms. Bryony remained standing with 1 foot still on the garden path, the other on the front step. A wireless in the landlady's sitting room came on, and the laughter of an audience swelled as the valves warmed. There followed a comedian's wheedling monologue, broken at last by applause, and a jolly band striking up. Bryony took a step into the hallway. She murmured, "I have to talk to you." Cecilia was about to get up, then changed her mind.
"Why didn't you tell me you were coming?"
"You didn't answer my letter, so I came."
She drew her dressing gown around her and patted its pocket, probably in the hope of a cigarette. She was much darker in complexion, and her hands, too, were brown. She had not found what she wanted, but for the moment she did not make to rise. Marking time rather than changing the subject, she said,
"You're a probationer?"
"Yes."
"Whose ward?"
"Sister Drummond's."
There was no telling whether Cecilia was familiar with this name or whether she was displeased that her younger sister was training at the same hospital. There was another obvious difference. Cecilia had always spoken to her in a motherly or condescending way. Little sis.
No room for that now. There was a hardness in her tone that warned Bryony off asking about Robbie. She took another step further into the hallway, conscious of the front door open behind her. And where are you?
Near Morden. It's an EMS.
An emergency medical services hospital. A commandeered place, most likely dealing with the brunt, the real brunt of the evacuation. There was too much that couldn't be said or asked. The two sisters looked at each other. Even though Cecilia had the rumpled look of someone who had just got out of bed, she was more beautiful than Bryony remembered her. That long face always looked odd and vulnerable. Horsey, everyone said, even in the best of lights. Now it looked boldly sensual, with an accentuated bow of the full purplish lips. The eyes were dark and enlarged, by fatigue, perhaps, or sorrow. The long, fine nose, the dainty flare of the nostrils, there was something mask-like and carved about the face, and very still, and hard to read. Her sister's appearance added to Bryony's unease and made her feel clumsy. She barely knew this woman, whom she hadn't seen in 5 years. Bryony could take nothing for granted. She was searching for another neutral topic, but there was nothing that did not lead back to the sensitive subjects, the subjects she was going to have to confront in any case. And it was because she could no longer bear the silence and the staring that she said at last, "Have you heard from the old man?"
"No, I haven't."
The downward tone implied she didn't want to and wouldn't care or reply if she did. Cecilia said, "Have you?"
"I had a scribbled note a couple of weeks ago."
"Good." So there was no more to be said on that. After another pause, Bryony tried again.
"What about from home?"
"No, I'm not in touch, and you?"
"She writes, now and then."
"And what's her news, Bryony?" The question and the use of her name was sardonic. As she forced her memory back, she felt she was being exposed as a traitor to her sister's cause.
"They've taken in evacuees, and Betty hates them. The park's been ploughed up for corn."
She trailed away. It was inane to be standing there listing these details. But Cecilia said coldly, "Go on. What else?"
"Well, most of the lads in the village have joined the East Surreys, except for..."
"Except for Danny Hardman. Yes, I know all about that." She smiled in a bright, artificial way, waiting for Bryony to continue.
"They've built a pillbox by the post office, and they've taken up all the old railings. Aunt Hermione's living in Nice. And, oh yes, Betty broke Uncle Clem's vase."
Only now was Cecilia roused from her coolness. She uncrossed her arms and pressed her hand against her cheek.
"Broke? She dropped it on a step."
"You mean properly broken, in lots of pieces?"
"Yes."
Cecilia considered this. Finally she said, "That's terrible."
"Yes," Bryony said. "Poor Uncle Clem."
At least her sister was no longer derisive. The interrogation continued.
"Did they keep the pieces?" "I don't know. Emily said the old man shouted at Betty."
At that moment, the door snapped open and the landlady stood right in front of Bryony, so close to her that she could smell peppermint on the woman's breath. She pointed at the front door.
"This isn't a railway station. Either you're in, young lady, or you're out."
Cecilia was getting to her feet without any particular hurry and was retying the silk cord of her dressing gown. She said languidly,
"This is my sister, Bryony, Mrs. Jarvis. Try and remember your manners when you speak to her." "In my own home, I'll speak as I please," Mrs. Jarvis said.
She turned back to Bryony.
Stay if you're staying, otherwise leave now and close the door behind you.
Bryony looked at her sister, guessing that she was unlikely to let her go now. Mrs. Jarvis had turned out to be an unwitting ally. Cecilia spoke as though they were alone.
Don't mind the landlady. I'm leaving at the end of the week. Close the door and come up.
Watched by Mrs. Jarvis, Bryony began to follow her sister up the stairs.
And as for you, Lady Muck,
the landlady called up. But Cecilia turned sharply and cut her off.
Enough, Mrs. Jarvis, now that's quite enough.
Bryony recognised the tone. Pure Nightingale, for use on difficult patients or tearful students. It took years to perfect. Cecilia had surely been promoted to ward sister. On the first floor landing, as she was about to open her door, she gave Bryony a look, a cool glance to let her know that nothing had changed, nothing had softened. From the bathroom, across the way, through its half-open door, drifted a humid, scented air and a hollow, dripping sound. Cecilia had been about to take a bath. She led Bryony into her flat. Some of the tidiest nurses on the ward lived in stews in their own rooms, and she would not have been surprised to see a new version of Cecilia's old chaos. But the impression here was of a simple and lonely life. A medium-sized room had been divided to make a narrow strip of a kitchen and presumably a bedroom next door. The walls were papered with a design of pale vertical stripes, like a boy's pyjamas, which heightened the sense of confinement. The lino was irregular off-cuts from downstairs, and in places, grey floorboard showed. Under the single-sash window was a sink with one tap and a one-ring gas cooker. Against the wall, leaving little room to squeeze by, was a table covered with a yellow gingham cloth. On it was a jam jar of blue flowers, harebells perhaps, and a full ashtray and a pile of books. At the bottom were Gray's Anatomy and a collected Shakespeare, and above them, on slenderer spines, names in faded silver and gold, she saw Houseman and Crab. By the books were two bottles of stout. In the corner, furthest from the window, was the door to the bedroom, on which was tacked a map of Northern Europe. Cecilia took a cigarette from a packet by the cooker, and then, remembering that her sister was no longer a child, offered one to her. There were two kitchen chairs by the table, but Cecilia, who leaned with her back to the sink, did not invite Bryony to sit down. The two women smoked and waited, so it seemed to Bryony, for the air to clear of the landlady's presence. Cecilia said in a quiet, level voice, "When I got your letter, I went to see a solicitor. It's not straightforward unless there's hard new evidence. Your change of heart won't be enough. Lola will go on saying she doesn't know. Our only hope was old Hardman, and now he's dead."
Hardman?
The contending elements, the fact of his death, his relevance to the case, confused Bryony, and she struggled with her memory. Was Hardman out that night looking for the twins? Did he see something? Was something said in court that she didn't know about?
Didn't you know he was dead?
No, but
unbelievable.
Cecilia's attempts at a neutral, factual tone were coming apart. Agitated, she came away from the cooking area, squeezed past the table and went to the other end of the room and stood by the bedroom door. Her voice was breathy as she tried to control her anger.
How odd that Emily didn't include that in her news along with the corn and the evacuees. He had cancer. Perhaps with a fear of God in him, he was saying something in his last days that was rather too inconvenient for everyone at this stage. "But see," she snapped, "don't call me that."
She repeated in a softer voice, "Please don't call me that." Her fingers were on the handle of the bedroom door, and it looked like the interview was coming to an end. She was about to disappear. With an implausible display of calm, she summarised for Bryony.
What I paid 2 guineas to discover is this. There isn't going to be an appeal just because 5 years on you've decided to tell the truth.
I don't understand what you're saying.
Bryony wanted to get back to Hardman, but Cecilia needed to tell her what must have gone through her head many times lately.
It isn't difficult. If you were lying then, why should a court believe you now? There are no new facts, and you're an unreliable witness.
Bryony carried her half-smoked cigarette to the sink. She was feeling sick. She took a saucer for an ashtray from the plate rack. Her sister's confirmation of her crime was terrible to hear. But the perspective was unfamiliar. Weak, stupid, confused, cowardly, evasive. She had hated herself for everything she had been, but she had never thought of herself as a liar. How strange and how clear it must seem to Cecilia. It was obvious and irrefutable. And yet, for a moment, she even thought of defending herself. She hadn't intended to mislead. She hadn't acted out of malice. But who would believe that? She stood where Cecilia had stood, with her back to the sink, and unable to meet her sister's eyes, said, "What I did was terrible. I don't expect you to forgive me."
"Don't worry about that," she said soothingly,
and in the second or two during which she drew deeply on her cigarette, Bryony flinched as her hopes lifted unreally. "Don't worry," her sister resumed. "I won't ever forgive you."
"And if I can't go to court, that won't stop me telling everyone what I did."
As her sister gave a wild little laugh, Bryony realized how frightened she was of Cecilia. Her derision was even harder to confront than her anger. This narrow room with its stripes like bars contained a history of feeling that no one could imagine. Bryony pressed on. She was, after all, in a part of the conversation she had rehearsed.
"I'll go to Surrey and speak to Emily and the old man. I'll tell them everything."
"Yes. You said that in your letter." "What's stopping you? You've had 5 years. Why haven't you been?"
"I wanted to see you first."
Cecilia came away from the bedroom door and stood by the table. She dropped her stub into the neck of a stout bottle. There was a brief hiss, and a thin line of smoke rose from the black glass. Her sister's action made Bryony feel nauseous again. She had thought the bottles were full. She wondered if she had ingested something unclean with her breakfast. Cecilia said, "I know why you haven't been. Because your guess is the same as mine. They don't want to hear anything more about it. That unpleasantness is all in the past, thank you very much. What's done is done. Why stir things up now? And you know very well they believed Hardman's story." Bryony came away from the sink and stood right across the table from her sister. It was not easy to look into that beautiful mask. She said very deliberately,
"I don't understand what you're talking about. What's he got to do with this? I'm sorry he's dead. I'm sorry I didn't know."
At a sound, she started. The bedroom door was opening, and Robbie stood before them. He wore army trousers and shirt and polished boots, and his braces hung free at his waist. He was unshaven and tousled, and his gaze was on Cecilia only. She had turned to face him, but she did not go toward him. In the seconds during which they looked at each other in silence, Bryony, partly obscured by her sister, shrank into her uniform. He spoke to Cecilia quietly, as though they were alone. "I heard voices, and I guessed it was something to do with the hospital."
"That's all right."
He looked at his watch. "Better get moving." As he crossed the room just before he went out onto the landing, he made a brief nod in Bryony's direction. "Excuse me." They heard the bathroom door close. Into the silence, Cecilia said, as if there were nothing between her and her sister, "He sleeps so deeply, I didn't want to wake him."
Then she added, I thought it would be better if you didn't meet.
Bryony's knees were actually beginning to tremble. Supporting herself with one hand on the table, she moved away from the kitchen area so that Cecilia could fill the kettle. Bryony longed to sit down. She would not do so until invited, and she would never ask. So she stood by the wall, pretending not to lean against it, and watched her sister. What was surprising was the speed with which her relief that Robbie was alive was supplanted by her dread of confronting him. Now she had seen him walk across the room, the other possibility, that he could have been killed, seemed outlandish, against all the odds. It would have made no sense. She was staring at her sister's back as she moved about the tiny kitchen. Bryony wanted to tell her how wonderful it was that Robbie had come back safely. What deliverance. But how banal that would have sounded. And she had no business saying it. She feared her sister and her scorn. Still feeling nauseous and now hot, Bryony pressed her cheek against the wall. It was no cooler than her face. She longed for a glass of water, but she did not want to ask her sister for anything. Briskly, Cecilia moved about her tasks, mixing milk and water to egg powder and setting out a pot of jam and three plates and cups on the table. Bryony registered this, but it gave her no comfort. It only increased her foreboding of the meeting that lay ahead. Did Cecilia really think that in this situation they could sit together and still have an appetite for scrambled eggs? Or was she soothing herself by being busy? Bryony was listening out for footsteps on the landing, and it was to distract herself that she attempted a conversational tone. She had seen the cape hanging on the back of the door. Cecilia, are you a ward sister now?
Yes, I am.
She said it with a downward finality, closing off the subject. Their shared profession was not going to be a bond. Nothing was, and there was nothing to talk about until Robbie came back. At last she heard the click of the lock on the bathroom door. He was whistling as he crossed the landing. Bryony moved away from the door, further down toward the darker end of the room. But she was in his sight line as he came in. He had half raised his right hand in order to shake hers, and his left trailed, about to close the door behind him. If it was a double take, it was undramatic. As soon as their eyes met, his hands dropped to his sides, and he gave a little winded sigh as he continued to look at her hard. However intimidated, she felt she could not look away. She smelled the faint perfume of his shaving soap. The shock was how much older he looked, especially around the eyes. Did everything have to be her fault? She wondered stupidly. Couldn't it also be the wars?
This ends Disc 11. Atonement, Disc 12.
So it was you, he said finally. He pushed the door closed behind him with his foot. Cecilia had come to stand by his side, and he looked at her. She gave an exact summary, but even if she had wanted, she would not have been able to withhold her sarcasm. Bryony is going to tell everybody the truth. She wanted to see me first. He turned back to Bryony. Did you think I might be here? Her immediate concern was not to cry. At that moment, nothing would have been more humiliating. Relief, shame, self-pity. She didn't know which it was, but it was coming. The smooth wave rose, tightening her throat, making it impossible to speak. And then, as she held on, tensing her lips, it fell away and she was safe. No tears, but her voice was a miserable whisper. I didn't know if you were alive. Cecilia said, if we're going to talk, we should sit down. I don't know that I can. He moved away impatiently to the adjacent wall, a distance of 7 feet or so, and leaned against it, arms crossed, looking from Bryony to Cecilia. Almost immediately he moved again, down the room to the bedroom door, where he turned to come back, changed his mind and stood there, hands in pockets. He was a large man, and the room seemed to have shrunk. In the confined space he was desperate in his movements, as though suffocating. He took his hands from his pockets and smoothed the hair at the back of his neck. Then he rested his hands on his hips. Then he let them drop. It took all this time, all this movement, for Bryony to realize that he was angry, very angry. And just as she did, he said, "What are you doing here? Don't talk to me about Surrey. No one's stopping you going. Why are you here?" She said, "I had to talk to Cecilia." "Oh, yes. And what about?" "The terrible thing that I did." Cecilia was going toward him. "Robbie," she whispered. "Darling." She put her hand on his arm, but he pulled it clear. "I don't know why you let her in." Then to Bryony, "I'll be quite honest with you. I'm torn between breaking your stupid neck here and taking you outside and throwing you down the stairs." If it had not been for her recent experience, she would have been terrified. Sometimes she heard soldiers on the ward raging against their helplessness. At the height of their passion, it was foolish to reason with them or try to reassure them. It had to come out, and it was best to stand and listen. She knew that even offering to leave now could be provocative. So she faced Robbie and waited for the rest, her due. But she was not frightened of him, not physically. He did not raise his voice, though it was straining with contempt. "Have you any idea at all what it's like inside?" She imagined small high windows and a cliff face of brick, and thought perhaps she did, the way people imagined the different torments of hell. She shook her head faintly. To steady herself, she was trying to concentrate on the details of his transformation. The impression of added height was due to his parade ground posture. No Cambridge student ever stood so straight. Even in his distraction, his shoulders were well back, and his chin was raised like an old-fashioned boxer's. "No, of course you don't. And when I was inside, did that give you pleasure?"
"No."
"But you did nothing." She had thought about this conversation many times, like a child anticipating a beating. Now it was happening at last, and it was as if she wasn't quite here. She was watching from far away, and she was numb. But she knew his words would hurt her later. Cecilia had stood back. Now she put her hand again on Robbie's arm. He had lost weight, though he looked stronger, with a lean and stringy muscular ferocity. He half turned to her.
"Remember,"
Cecilia was starting to say, but he spoke over her.
"Do you think I assaulted your cousin?"
"No."
"Did you think it then?"
She fumbled her words.
Yes and no, I wasn't certain."
"And what's made you so certain now?" She hesitated, conscious that in answering she would be offering a form of defence, a rationale, and that it might enrage him further.
"Growing up."
He stared at her, lips slightly parted. He really had changed in 5 years. The hardness in his gaze was new, and the eyes were smaller and narrower, and in the corners were the firm prints of crow's feet. His face was thinner than she remembered, the cheeks were sunken like an Indian brave's. He had grown a little toothbrush moustache in the military style. He was startlingly handsome. And there came back to her from years ago, when she was 10 or 11, the memory of a passion she'd had for him, a real crush that had lasted days. Then she confessed it to him one morning in the garden and immediately forgot about it. She had been right to be wary.
He was gripped by the kind of anger that passes itself off as wonderment.
"Growing up," he echoed.
When he raised his voice, she jumped.
"God damn it, you're 18. How much growing up do you need to do? There are soldiers dying in the field at 18, old enough to be left to die on the roads. Did you know that?"
"Yes."
It was a pathetic source of comfort that he could not know what she had seen. Strange that for all her guilt, she should feel the need to withstand him. It was that or be annihilated. She barely nodded. She did not dare speak. At the mention of dying, a surge of feeling had engulfed him, pushing him beyond anger into an extremity of bewilderment and disgust. His breathing was irregular and heavy. He clenched and unclenched his right fist. And still he stared at her, into her, with a rigidity, a savagery in his look. His eyes were bright, and he swallowed hard several times. The muscles in his throat tensed and knotted. He too was fighting off an emotion he did not want witnessed. She had learned, the little she knew, the tiny, next-to-nothing scraps that came the way of a trainee nurse in the safety of the ward and the bedside. She knew enough to recognize that memories were crowding in and there was nothing he could do. They wouldn't let him speak. She would never know what scenes were driving this turmoil. He took a step toward her and she shrank back, no longer certain of his harmlessness. If he couldn't talk, he might have to act. Another step, and he could have reached her with his sinewy arm. But Cecilia slid between them. With her back to Bryony, she faced Robbie and placed her hands on his shoulders. He turned his face away from her.
"Look at me," she murmured. "Robbie, look at me."
The reply he made was lost to Bryony. She heard his dissent or denial. Perhaps it was an obscenity. As Cecilia gripped him tighter, he twisted his whole body away from her, and they seemed like wrestlers as she reached up and tried to turn his head toward her. But his face was tilted back, his lips retracted, and teeth bared in a ghoulish parody of a smile. Now, with two hands, she was gripping his cheeks tightly, and with an effort she turned his face and drew it toward her own. At last he was looking into her eyes, but still she kept her grip on his cheeks. She pulled him closer, drawing him into her gaze, until their faces met and she kissed him lightly, lingeringly on the lips. With a tenderness that Bryony remembered from years ago, waking in the night, Cecilia said, "Come back. Robbie, come back." He nodded faintly and took a deep breath, which he released slowly as she relaxed her grip and withdrew her hands from his face. In the silence, the room appeared to shrink even smaller. He put his arms around her, lowered his head and kissed her, a deep, sustained and private kiss. Bryony moved away quietly to the other end of the room toward the window. While she drank a glass of water from the kitchen tap, the kiss continued, binding the couple into their solitude. She felt obliterated, expunged from the room, and was relieved. She turned her back and looked out at the quiet terraced houses in full sunlight, at the way she had come from the high street. She was surprised to discover that she had no wish to leave yet, even though she was embarrassed by the long kiss and dreaded what more there was to come. She watched an old woman dressed in a heavy overcoat, despite the heat. She was on the far pavement, walking an ailing, swag-bellied dachshund on a lead. Cecilia and Robbie were talking in low voices now, and Bryony decided that to respect their privacy, she would not turn from the window until she was spoken to. It was soothing to watch the woman unfasten her front gate, close it carefully behind her with fussy exactitude, and then, halfway to her front door, bend with difficulty to pull up a weed from the narrow bed that ran the length of her front path. As she did so, the dog waddled forward and licked her wrist. The lady and her dog went indoors, and the street was empty again. A blackbird dropped down onto a privet hedge, and finding no satisfactory foothold, flew away. The shadow of a cloud came and swiftly dimmed the light and passed on. It could be any Saturday afternoon. There was little evidence of a war in this suburban street. A glimpse of black outlines in a window across the way, the Ford 8 on its blocks, perhaps. Bryony heard her sister say her name and turned round. There isn't much time. Robbie has to report for duty at 6 tonight and he's got a train to catch, so sit down. There are some things you're going to do for us. It was the ward sister's voice, not even bossy. She simply described the inevitable. Bryony took the chair nearest her. Robbie brought over a stool and Cecilia sat between them. The breakfast she had prepared was forgotten. The three empty cups stood in the centre of the table. He lifted the pile of books to the floor. As Cecilia moved the jam jar of harebells to one side, where it could not be knocked over, she exchanged a look with Robbie. He was staring at the flowers as he cleared his throat. When he began to speak, his voice was purged of emotion. He could have been reading from a set of standing orders. He was looking at her now. His eyes were steady, and he had everything under control. But there were drops of sweat on his forehead above his eyebrows. "The most important thing you've already agreed to. You're to go to your parents as soon as you can and tell them everything they need to know to be convinced that your evidence was false. When's your day off? Sunday week. That's when you'll go. You'll take our addresses and you'll tell Jack and Emily that Cecilia is waiting to hear from them. The second thing you'll do tomorrow. Cecilia says you'll have an hour at some point. You'll go to a solicitor, a commissioner for oaths, and make a statement which will be signed and witnessed. In it, you'll say what you did wrong and how you're retracting your evidence. You'll send copies to both of us. Is that clear? Yes. Then you'll write to me in much greater detail. In this letter, you'll put in absolutely everything you think is relevant. Everything that led up to you saying you saw me by the lake. And why, even though you were uncertain, you stuck to your story in the months leading up to my trial. If there were pressures on you from the police or your parents, I want to know. Have you got that? It needs to be a long letter. Yes. He met Cecilia's look and nodded. And if you can remember anything at all about Danny Hardman, where he was, what he was doing, at what time, who else saw him, anything that might put his alibi in question, then we want to hear it. Cecilia was writing out the addresses. Bryony was shaking her head and starting to speak, but Robbie ignored her and spoke over her. He had got to his feet and was looking at his watch. There's very little time. We're going to walk you to the tube. Cecilia and I want the last hour together alone before I have to leave. And you'll need to spend the rest of today writing your statement and letting your parents know you're coming. And you could start thinking about this letter you're sending me. With this brittle précis of her obligations, he left the table and went toward the bedroom. Bryony stood too and said, "Old Hardman was probably telling the truth. Danny was with him all that night." Cecilia was about to pass the folded sheet of paper she had been writing on. Robbie had stopped in the bedroom doorway. Cecilia said, "What do you mean by that? What are you saying?" "It was Paul Marshall." During the silence that followed, Bryony tried to imagine the adjustments that each would be making. Years of seeing it a certain way. And yet, however startling, it was only a detail. Nothing essential was changed by it. Nothing in her own role. Robbie came back to the table. "Marshall?"
"Yes."
"You saw him?"
"I saw a man his height."
"My height?"
"Yes."
Cecilia now stood and looked around her. A hunt for the cigarettes was about to start. Robbie found them and tossed the packet across the room. Cecilia lit up and said as she exhaled,
"I find it difficult to believe. He's a fool, I know."
"He's a greedy fool," Robbie said. "But I can't imagine him with Lola Quincy, even for the 5 minutes it took." Given all that had happened, and all its terrible consequences, it was frivolous, she knew, but Bryony took calm pleasure in delivering her clinching news.
"I've just come from their wedding."
Again the amazed adjustments, the incredulous repetition.
"Wedding? This morning? Clapham?"
Then reflective silence, broken by single remarks.
"I want to find him." "You'll do no such thing. I want to kill him."
And then,
"It's time to go."
There was so much more that could have been said, but they seemed exhausted by her presence or by the subject. Or they simply longed to be alone. Either way, it was clear they felt their meeting was at an end. All curiosity was spent. Everything could wait until she wrote her letter. Robbie fetched his jacket and cap from the bedroom. Bryony noted the corporal's single stripe. Cecilia was saying to him,
"He's immune. She'll always cover for him."
Minutes were lost while she searched for her ration book. Finally, she gave up and said to Robbie,
"I'm sure it's in Wiltshire, in the cottage."
As they were about to leave, and he was holding the door open for the sisters, Robbie said, "I suppose we owe an apology to Abel Seaman Hardman." Downstairs, Mrs. Jarvis did not appear from her sitting room as they went by. They heard clarinets playing on her wireless. Once through the front door, it seemed to Bryony that she was stepping into another day. There was a strong, gritty breeze blowing, and the street was in harsh relief, with even more sunlight, fewer shadows than before. There was not enough room on the pavement to go three abreast. Robbie and Cecilia walked behind her hand in hand. Bryony felt her blistered heel rubbing against her shoe, but she was determined they should not see her limp. She had the impression of being seen off the premises. At one point she turned and told them she would be happy to walk to the tube on her own, but they insisted. They had purchases to make for Robbie's journey. They walked on in silence. Small talk was not an option. She knew that she did not have the right to ask her sister about her new address, or Robbie where the train was taking him, or about the cottage in Wiltshire. Was that where the harebells came from? Surely there had been an idyll. Nor could she ask when the two of them would see each other again. Together, she and her sister and Robbie had only one subject, and it was fixed in the unchangeable past. They stood outside Balham Tube Station, which in 3 months' time would achieve its terrible form of fame in the Blitz. A thin stream of Saturday shoppers moved around them, causing them against their will to stand closer. They made a cool farewell. Robbie reminded her to have money with her when she saw the Commissioner for Oaths. Cecilia told her she was not to forget to take the addresses with her to Surrey. Then it was over. They stared at her, waiting for her to leave. But there was one thing she had not said. She spoke slowly.
"I'm very, very sorry. I've caused you such terrible distress."
They continued to stare at her, and she repeated herself.
"I'm very sorry."
It sounded so foolish and inadequate, as though she had knocked over a favourite houseplant or forgotten a birthday. Robbie said softly, "Just do all the things we've asked." It was almost conciliatory, that "just," but not quite, not yet. She said, "Of course." And then turned and walked away, conscious of them watching her as she entered the ticket hall and crossed it. She paid her fare to Waterloo. When she reached the barrier, she looked back and they had gone. She showed her ticket and went through into the dirty yellow light to the head of the clanking, creaking escalator, and it began to take her down into the man-made breeze rising from the blackness, the breath of a million Londoners cooling her face and tugging at her cape. She stood still and let herself be carried down, grateful to be moving without scouring her heel. She was surprised at how serene she felt, and just a little sad. Was it disappointment? She had hardly expected to be forgiven. What she felt was more like homesickness, though there was no source for it, no home. But she was sad to leave her sister. It was her sister she missed, or more precisely, it was her sister with Robbie. Their love. Neither Bryony nor the war had destroyed it. This was what soothed her as she sank deeper under the city. How Cecilia had drawn him to her with her eyes. That tenderness in her voice when she called him back from his memories, from Dunkirk, or from the roads that led to it. She used to speak like that to her sometimes, when Cecilia was 16 and she was a child of 6, and things went impossibly wrong. Or in the night when Cecilia came to rescue her from a nightmare and take her into her own bed. Those were the words she used. Come back. It was only a bad dream, Bryony. Come back. How easily this unthinking family love was forgotten. She was gliding down now through the soupy brown light almost to the bottom. There were no other passengers in sight, and the air was suddenly still. She was calm as she considered what she had to do. Together, the note to her parents and the formal statement would take no time at all. Then she would be free for the rest of the day. She knew what was required of her. Not simply a letter, but a new draft, an atonement. And she was ready to begin. BT, London, 1999. London, 1999. What a strange time this has been. Today, on the morning of my 77th birthday, I decided to make one last visit to the Imperial War Museum Library in Lambeth. It suited my peculiar state of mind. The reading room, housed right up in the dome of the building, was formerly the chapel of the Royal Bethlehem Hospital, the Old Bedlam. Where the unhinged once came to offer their prayers, scholars now gather to research the collective insanity of war. The car the family was sending was not due until after lunch, so I thought I would distract myself checking final details and saying my farewells to the keeper of documents and to the cheerful porters who have been escorting me up and down in the lift during these wintry weeks. I also intended to donate to the archives my dozen-long letters from old Mr. Nettle. It was a birthday present to myself, I suppose, to pass an hour or two in a half pretense of seeming busy, fussing about with those little tasks of housekeeping that come at the end and are part of the reluctant process of letting go. In the same mood, I was busy in my study yesterday afternoon. Now the drafts are in order and dated, the photocopied sources labelled, the borrowed books ready for return, and everything is in the right box file. I've always liked to make a tidy finish. It was too cold and wet, and I was feeling too troubled to go by public transport. I took a taxi from Regent's Park, and in the long crawl through central London, I thought of those sad inmates of Bedlam, who were once a source of general entertainment, and I reflected in a self-pitying way on how I was soon to join their ranks. The results of my scan have come through, and I went to see my doctor about them yesterday morning. It was not good news. This was the way he put it as soon as I sat down. My headaches, the sensation of tightness around the temples, have a particular and sinister cause. He pointed out some granular smears across a section of the scan. I noticed how the pencil tip quivered in his hand, and I wondered if he too was suffering some neural disorder. In the spirit of shoot the messenger, I